Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 16th of March 1924, conservatives attempt to find some guiding principles, and fail. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. There's been a train crash in France. Now, you may be wondering why I would be bothering to mention that, but it turned out there were a lot of Britons on board, on their way to the Riviera. A company has been painting their buses red and putting the word genial on the side. The largest London bus company, the London General Omnibus Company, who paint their buses red and put the word general on the side, and have done so for rather longer, have taken their rivals to court on the basis that these actions constitute a colourable imitation. The court has agreed with them. Arnold Yarrow, whose scheme for building a flyover at Oxford Circus I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, has been told by a conference of concerned authorities that his scheme is unsuitable in that particular place, but might be appropriate somewhere else. The Teapot Dome scandal continues to grind on. As well as the Interior Secretary, the Naval Secretary has been forced to resign. Attention is now focused on the Attorney General. American politicians using their position to line their pockets. Thank goodness those days are over. It's not the only thing whose days are over. This is from Monday the 10th. A large number of the members of the staff of the Great Western Railway assembled at Queen's Hall to take part in a concert in which the GWR London Musical Society and the choir and orchestra of the Swindon Society cooperated. Quite unimaginable today. Well, I say that, but there is still a GWR brass band that plays in the concourse at Paddington Station once a week. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned an attempt to relay radio programmes into a train carriage. It would appear that in-train entertainment experimentation is quite the thing. This is from Thursday the 13th. An interesting experiment was carried out by the London and North Eastern Railway yesterday, when for the first time film exhibitions were given in railway trains. A specially fitted saloon was attached to the Flying Scotchman. I refuse to believe that has anything to do with the Flying Scotsman. The 10 o'clock train from King's Cross to the North, and during the run to York, an American film, is that significant? Ashes of Vengeance, several reels in length, which has been seen in London, was gone through twice. At one end of the saloon, which was darkened as far as possible, was a screen. At the other end, the first-class carriage, which normally forms part of the coach, had been converted into a projection box, which satisfied all official safety requirements in the showing of a film. I should point out that in those days film was highly flammable. Oscillation did not affect the exhibition at all, and the only drawback was the difficulty of keeping the coach perfectly dark. I've never heard of such a thing, so I guess it didn't take off. That's a really poor choice of words. This is precisely what used to happen on long-haul aircraft, so it did take off. But why didn't it work on trains? It sounds like an ideal way to use a dining car outside mealtimes. I'm guessing there just wasn't the demand. Right, quiz time. How much did the Royal Navy cost in the 1920s? Remember, the war is over, the main opponent, the German Navy, lies at the bottom of Scapa Flow, and the Washington Naval Treaty limits the number of ships that Britain can possess. Time's up. Well, if you guessed £55,800,000, or 11 million ounces of gold, or 18 billion in today's money, or 9 billion in today's money after you have applied the Crozier fudge factor, well done. And what's the figure today? Try as I might, I have been unable to find one. The best I can do is the overall defence budget, which for 2021-22 was 45.9 billion. So our 9 billion, or even our 18 billion, seems a very low number. Earlier on in the article, the writer makes the point that The scale of expenditure on the Navy has been brought much below the 1914-15 standard. In fact, to what it was about the year 1903-4, prior to the concentration of the fleet in home waters and its expansion to meet the growing German menace. But that was a time when Britain had the largest navy in the world and maintained a two-power standard. The Royal Navy was to equal the next two navies combined. So, were our ancestors simply better at it? I'd be happy to accept that conclusion, but could there be another explanation? Could it be that procurement has simply got harder and more expensive? Maybe, although it's worth pointing out that it was pretty hard then. Guns, propellants, explosives, armour, rangefinders and directors, to mention just the technologies present on battleships, were all state-of-the-art and far from flawless. Continuing the military theme, William Robertson is the only man ever to rise from private to field marshal in the British Army. From 1915 to 1917, he was the chief of the Imperial General Staff and responsible for strategy. It's a role that tends not to attract a great deal of attention, but is extremely important. As far as I am aware, he got most of it right. For his efforts, he was sacked. I'm sure Valerius Luzhny knows the feeling. On Monday, the Times reported on a speech Robertson gave to the Working Men's College in St Pancras, in which Robertson recalled his early days as a soldier. The old soldiers in his regiment were a hard-drinking, hard-swearing lot, and enlistment at that time was looked upon as bringing disgrace on the recruit's family. I've heard that soldiers were looked down upon before the First World War. It's pleasing to hear it confirmed. Men who went sick got their medicine about 36 hours after they reported sick. There were no nurses in the army then, the nursing being carried out by the hospital orderly, who slept in the room, who generally had too much beer, and whose attention to his patients was regulated by the tips he received from them. My understanding is that during the First World War, if you were in need of medical attention, you wanted British medical attention. Sir William admitted that he hesitated a long time before he took a commission, as he had no private means, which were absolutely necessary in a cavalry regiment. Taking a commission means becoming an officer. I believe he received some help. But it does make you wonder what other talents the British Army may have been missing out on. Things changed a lot during the war, when the army was crying out for officers. The field marshal said that a lady who asked him what statesman most impressed him during the war was much surprised when he replied, "Lord Carson and Mr. John Redmond." During the Ulster crisis before the war, Redmond was the leader of the Irish Nationalists and Carson of the Ulster Unionists. Politicians in the military did not get on during the war. The politicians were constantly looking for easy ways out. It was the unpleasant task of the soldiers to point out the grim realities. The main effort had to be on the Western Front. Casualties would be high. Conscription was necessary. There's been a lot of correspondence on the subject of conservative ideals. As the Times explained in an editorial on Friday the 14th, it began with a letter from Sir Martin Conway, in which he declared that the trouble with the Conservative Party is that it lacks the fire of a great ideal, and has provoked all sorts of comment. This, for instance, is from a C. Stansfield Hicks. "How can your correspondent, Dr. L.P. Jacks, expect ideals in a population whose education for 40 years has been that material good is the only thing worth consideration? Today the gods of the masses and classes are money, machinery and amusement, motors, speed, football and betting." We're so much better today. If you substitute machinery for gadgetry, I think you've got the full set. "Idleness and fullness of bread in all ages have been the parents not of spirituality, but of sin and wickedness." And this is from an A.R. Howlett. "If socialists were the living exponents of only a half of their ideals, how much nearer their millennium would be. but this would mean to them a life of humdrum selflessness, with no limelight, only sacrifice. The other way brings public acclamation, with its false but satisfying appraisements. Just in case you thought virtue signalling was a new thing. The Times attempts to get back to the point. More mischief is being done, and more socialists created, at the present time, by the so-called anti-socialists, than by anybody else. Socialism is not primarily the product of dark and hideous forces, as some panic mongers would have us believe. It is the natural and inevitable result of the low wages, the inadequate housing, the insecurity of living conditions of too many of our fellow countrymen and women today. Powerful words. Words that wound the libertarian in me. It is my belief that the Industrial Revolution was the greatest thing that ever happened to humanity. It made everyone richer. It dragged millions out of poverty. But here we have people who are much closer to events expressing deep dissatisfaction with the results. Conservatism rightly rejects it, i.e. socialism, not because it wants to back the employer as against the employed, but because it is convinced that the remedy will prove far worse than the disease. Well, they're not wrong. But the Conservative Party will never succeed in winning the support of the electorate by abusing their socialist fellow countrymen as the agents of foreigners or as the gullible victims of a subtle intrigue. It will do so only by a convincing exposure of the fallacies of socialism and by offering a better, because it is a more practical solution, of the admitted industrial evils of our time. As it happens, huge spoiler alert, the Conservative Party will succeed in winning the support of the electorate by accusing their opponents, falsely it must be said, of being foreign agents, this very year in fact. But despite being wrong, they're right. You have to win the battle of ideas. For what it's worth, I don't think there's a conservative solution to the evils they cite. The only thing that in the long run lifts up the great mass of the people is freedom. As for exposing the fallacies of socialism, the conservatives had only a minor role to play. It was reality that had to do the heavy lifting. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.